I was reading a couple weeks ago, a few weeks ago, in the Wall Street Journal, and this headline just kind of popped out at me, and here's what it said. Some type A staffers dress for success with Botox shot. In the beginning, the article said this. Wipe that smirk off your face. It's bad for business. Yes, it's come to this. In the world of cutthroat capitalism, betraying emotion can cost a sale, a job, a jury verdict. So, growing numbers of salesmen and lawyers, bankers and stockbrokers are fixing their facial expressions with Botox, freezing and sculpting their faces into semi-permanent serenity. Now, I don't know if you're aware of this whole Botox thing. Basically, you have a trained professional, a medical professional, take a needle and inject botulism into your face. And it actually paralyzes the muscles and the tissue surrounding it. And it started out a few years ago with people who were just trying to eliminate age lines. And now, apparently, it's gone to help people eliminate their sagging sales. So stockbrokers now look rested when they're trying to make a sale, when in reality they've been staring at a screen all night long. Trial lawyers look cool and confident, when that's only because they've had Botox injected up here and their sweat glands don't operate anymore. Salesmen seem cool when they shake hands, but only because the sweat has been diminished in here because those glands have been paralyzed as well. Real estate developers, negotiators, they look nonchalant, but all the while there's an ulcer burning through their stomach wall lining. One principal at a real estate investment firm says he attributes his 10 to 30% increase in sales to being able to give this facade that he is a cool, calm customer. And you know, this is really the epitome of faking it, actually taking medical measures to fake something on the outside that does not mirror on the inside. Now, I do have a sick part of me. I really do. And so I enjoyed hearing about some of the horror stories. You know, like some people, one person had the upper two-thirds of her face paralyzed, and she just, temporarily, not permanently, it wears off. It couldn't go to work because when animated conversations would happen, nothing would move on her face except, you know, this little part right here. And people go, you are weird looking. Another person was nicknamed Spock because when they would smile, the only thing that would move was the very corners of their mouth up like this and kind of looked like Joker and Batman. And this is really a physical extension of an internal decision that most people make. The decision to fake it. The decision to not be real. To not turn up the volume. To not experience the full bandwidth of you will, of our emotions and perceptions and our experiences in life. And nobody likes being faked. And I don't really think any of us really like faking others. I mean, we just don't have time for that. I mean, I don't like it, but unfortunately, there are some realities that I have to wrestle with. Like when I go to a party or something like that where people don't know me, there's a standard line of conversation that you always have to get the conversation going. What's the first thing you ask somebody? No, not how you're doing. Well, you might ask how you're doing, but no, I ask them, what's your name? So what's your name? Now, that's my third question because I forget it immediately. It's just there to start the conversation going, you know, what's your name? And then what's normally the second question? What do you do? That's exactly what do you do? Now, I can't ask that question because when I ask, well, so what do you do? What's going to happen? What are they going to ask? And what do you do? That's right. And so when they say, what do you do? What happens with me is then I've got to drop the P-bomb. I got to say, I'm a pastor. And all of a sudden, like their face goes Botox, goes, and they rewind in their mind all the jokes they've told. They rewind in their mind the verbiage they've used. They think what I've said. And, you know, so, and all of a sudden what happens is the Batmobile happens right in front of me. You know, the protective shield goes all over them. You know, and so, oh, none of you holy roller type getting around me. You know, it is now time for me to fake it, for me to not let you into my world. And so I can't ask that question until we've actually developed a repertoire or a rapport. Rapport. There you go. Spell that word, by the way. That's a hard one. So I can't really ask that until they've gotten to know me for who I am, and then we can get past that baggage. But I don't like not being able to be real with other people. We should all want to live out loud, have the full range of who we are, be able to be seen for the way it really is. But as it stands, very few of us are real with ourselves, or real with God, or real with others. And actually, those are the three realms of realness I want to talk about today to get us started in this series. And we're actually going to look at these in greater depth throughout this series. Let's talk about the three realms of realness today. And we're going to take a look at this by looking at a real life scenario that happened with Jesus, where he experienced all the realms of realness. And this comes from the book of Mark, chapter 14. Let's just go ahead and take a look at what it says. They went to a place called Gethsemane, and Jesus said to his disciples, "Sit here while I pray." He took Peter, James, and John along with him, and he began to be deeply distressed and troubled. Now, this is a true life story where we're going to see Jesus interact with himself, interact with God, and interact with other people. And you may see Jesus in a way in which you have never seen him before as a result of this story. This is the way that most of us have only ever seen Jesus, you know, like this. You could call this storybook Jesus. You could call this Eurocentric Jesus. You could call this Botox Jesus. You know, the Jesus who just is blah, expressionless. "Oh, I love you." You know, he doesn't really get intense, doesn't really get expressive, doesn't get real. He's just kind of the holy veneer on him. This is not what we're seeing at the beginning of this verse. Because when it says he is deeply distressed, what it is saying is Jesus is having an intensive emotional reaction. Now, scholars, when they've taken a look at this, they think that what's happening here is this is right before Jesus is arrested, tried, and crucified. And Jesus, being a person who understands the Jewish scriptures, realizes that in the Jewish scriptures, there's this prophecy about a suffering servant who will suffer for the good of his people. Really graphic, hard stuff that's going to happen. And they believe that Jesus finally puts it all together, that he is the suffering servant, and this is the moment. His run is done. All the stuff that's happening, it's now coming to an end, because he's about to enter into heavy, heavy pain mode. And so when it says he's deeply distressed, it's not the kind of stress where, well, there's too much month at the end of my money. This is, you know, Fred Sanford, this is the big one, Ethel, whatever her name was, stress. Whoa, this is deep. And here's what he says. He says, "My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death." He said to them, to his friends, "Stay here and keep watch." First realm of realness, he is being real with himself. We need to be real with ourselves. To be real with yourself, it requires that you know yourself, that you're self-aware. And what Jesus is displaying here is what Daniel Goleman would call emotional intelligence. I don't know if you're aware of this guy's book. He's got an interesting thing where he talks about emotional intelligence. And he also wrote a more recent book called Primal Leadership that kind of talks about the same thing. And basically what emotional intelligence, his thesis about this, is that it is not our IQ that dictates whether or not we will advance in life or grow. It's not our IQ, our intelligence quotient. It's our EQ, our emotional quotient, or our EI, our emotional intelligence. And that is the ability for people to know what's really going on inside and to recognize the emotional reactions that we're having and to harness those emotions and react in a way that is appropriate for the situation, that is helpful to those around us, helpful to the organization, and helpful to ourselves. That there is a power in our emotions that needs to be intelligently harnessed and released, as opposed to using our emotions for the fulfillment of our own emotional life, which is the way most people are. They're very emotionally unintelligent. I feel, therefore I do it. I feel, therefore I vent. I feel, therefore I blurt. This is what they say, and it says in his most recent book, Primal Leadership, says this. Leaders high in emotional self-awareness are attuned to their inner signals, recognizing how their feelings affect them and their job performance. Emotionally self-aware leaders or people can be candid and authentic, able to speak openly about their emotions. Candid and authentic, able to speak openly about their emotions. You know, this means that we are able to be vulnerable. And we're able to be vulnerable because we recognize something is happening inside. And this is what it means to be self-aware. You go, okay, why am I feeling this way? What is this emotion? Is this emotion based on reality? I need to be intelligent about how I feel this emotion, because this emotion might not be matched up with the way things really are. It could be baggage that I'm bringing with me. This last week I had somebody tell me something that really bummed me out. Now all of us, when we get depressed or get bummed out, we all have a different range, you know. So, you know, some of us have ranges or bandwidths that are like this. Others have bandwidths that are like this in the range of depression, or others have it like this. You know, we all have our bandwidth of depression. And for me, wherever my bandwidth is, it was a pretty intense one for me. Because this guy said something to me, I was like, oh, ow, ow. And I had to ask myself, okay, why am I feeling depressed right now? Before I start walking around like, ugh, I'm such a loser. Oh, you know, before I start walking around like that, why is that? And so I had to think about it. And I realized this person gave me a critique that really, if it's true, what it's saying is, in an area that you recognize as a weakness, you haven't grown at all. By the way, it's talking about being real. And I don't call it an opportunity. No, it's a weakness. Okay, oh, here's an opportunity. No, a weakness for you. You know, you stink at it. Not an opportunity for you. Let's be real. So anyway, in this area that I had a weakness in, I thought, oh man, maybe I haven't grown like I thought in this area. And if this guy's right, that really says something bad about me. And the ramifications could be huge. And I had to intelligently process through why I was feeling, what was underneath the emotion. See, most of us, we don't know ourselves well enough to do that kind of thinking. So what we do is we just ooze. You know what an oozer is, you know? You just kind of ooze your emotions on people, you know? You're depressed, you just ooze it on them. You'd make them depressed. And you're angry. And just vents, it just, you know, oozes on them. And you don't think about it. You don't try to contain it in an intelligent way and harness it in a powerful way. You feel, therefore you do. You feel, therefore you emote. And see, our feelings might not be in touch with reality. We might be allowing the easiest thing to happen, but not the best thing to happen. Let's take a look at somebody who's not in touch with reality and who is not self-aware.
I like you, Mary. I like you a lot. I want to ask you a question straight out, flat out. I want you to give me the honest answer. What do you think the chances are of a guy like you and a girl like me ending up together?
Well, Lloyd, that's difficult to say. We really don't...
Hit me with it. Just give it to me straight. I came a long way just to see you, Mary. Just least you can do is level with me. What are my chances?
Not good.
You mean not good like 1 out of 100?
I'd say more like 1 out of 1,000,000.
So you're telling me there's a chance? Yeah! I read you.
I like that. You know, a friend of mine taught me that the most difficult people to deal with are those who are deceived about themselves. The most difficult people to deal with are those who are deceived about themselves. They have strengths in this area, but they don't know it. They think they have a strength over here, but they don't. And they have an expectation that they can fill this role or do this when they can't. And they can't hear anything because they're deceived about themselves. They are the hardest people to deal with are the people who don't know themselves. And it takes hard work to know yourself because you have to stop and think about stuff. A couple weeks ago, I was on an airplane. And here's my deal when I'm on an airplane. You know, you kind of get down there, you get in your seat, you sit in your seat, And let's hope you got a one seat buffer on one side. That's the goal, you know, when you get on an airplane. You want that one seat buffer. And so I always have this nightmare thought that somebody is going to come onto the plane with a ticket that says, take whatever open seat you would like. And so I live in paranoia until the flight takes off that I keep that seat buffer. So you know what I do? I get in and I kind of want to send signals to everybody, you know. I kind of lean on that seat over here, and you know, I put put my foot over here and cross, and I take my briefcase, my laptop, put it there. I'll pile my books there. I'm communicating to everybody. Oh, everybody know this is my seat. Don't want to be sitting here. I need my zone. And, you know, I'll pull up my USA Today and I'll, you know, read it, and then I'll kind of bring it in front like this. And I'll look over the top of the people who are coming over down the aisle. You know, it's like they're coming down the aisle, they're looking at the numbers, going, where's my number? You know, they're kind of looking. And then someone like locks into one like 10 rows ahead of you, and you go, oh, yes, yes, yes. And then they walk past that, and their next person's looking, and they look at the numbers right above your head, and they will not move their eyes. You're going, no, 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 no. And they come in, they go, that's my seat. You're going, oh, man. Well, you know, you think about this. You know, what's going on there? It's not, well, I just want my seat buffer. No, no, there's something much deeper going on there. I started thinking about, here's what's going on. See, what I'm really doing is I'm broadcasting to people, I don't want you around me. And I don't want you around me because I need my space. And you might need the space too, but you know what? In reality, what's even underneath that is I'm more important than you. I'm more important than you, and I'm the one who needs the space, and you're really an inconvenience to me, and really what's going beneath that is really, it's all about me. And I will do whatever I need to do to keep you in your place, and me in my high and exalted place of having one seat buffer. Now you might think, no, that's not what it is for me, Brian, it's just a one seat buffer. You are walling yourself off looking at the hardcore reality with stuff like that. It's normally not about that. There's deeper stuff beneath that that it takes time and effort to know what's going on. Someone comes into your office and has a suggestion or makes a comment about something that's your area. You know? And what do? Do you go, oh, that's a dumb idea? Or do you say, oh, you know what? You just deal with your area. I'll deal with mine. Oh, you know. Why do you have the emotional reaction? Maybe it is because you feel threatened that they would speak to your area. Maybe you just intentionally forget about the idea for 2 months and then reintroduce the idea as your own. And then you take the credit for it. Why do you do that? Yesterday, Todd Henry, before our service on Saturday night, made a suggestion about something I might want to say in the midst of my message. And Todd, who's doing the music, is a great guy, good friend, or maybe a good guy, great friend, one or the other. He's really just a good dude. So he makes a suggestion. And I go, you know, that's a great idea. I thought about that. I'm going to make sure I do that. About a minute later, I think to myself, now why did I need to say, I thought of that. I'll make sure I do that. Why not just, yeah, good idea. You know why? I think it's because I'm more insecure than I give myself credit for. And for some reason, I felt like, you know, I'm more on top of my game and more the man if, like, nobody has to give me good ideas. Ow. You know, those are hard thoughts to think. And those are the kind of thoughts that emotionally intelligent people or people who know themselves or people who are real think. You know, my personal experience is I have yet to meet an atheist who is a true atheist. The atheists I have met and interacted with, not the agnostics, the atheists, are more committed to not dealing with deep anger and pain issues than they are committed to dealing with the idea of a God. In fact, the idea of there not being a God is a convenient thing that they use to suppress and rationalize some of the pain and anger that they have in their life that they're not willing to deal with. And so that's part of the puzzle for them, and they don't even realize it. They don't even realize it because they're not real with themselves. The ones I've met and interacted with. Second realm of realness outside of being real with ourselves is being real with God. Being real with God. You know, we're coming up into the 9/11 anniversary, and so this last week I was watching some television on it and started off with Monday night, watched the greatest television channel, cable channel in the history of man, or at least history of men. What is that channel? The History Channel. That's what I'm talking about. I mean, you're talking about, there's some television there, Jack. So anyway, I'm watching the History Channel, and this one's about the rise and the fall of the World Trade Center. Now, obviously, the fall was very sobering and saddening, and it was, you know, obviously emotionally intense. But in the beginning of that, I was really digging the whole structure of how they built the things and all that. Interesting. So that was my thing on Monday night. And then one of the other nights, I watched PBS Frontline. You know, you want to talk about opposite spectrums. History Channel, PBS. You mean totally different thing. So I watched PBS Frontline. It was actually a fascinating program on how 9/11 has affected the faith of people who were touched by 9/11, by losing loved ones, were actually living right there close to Ground Zero. And I sat, and as I watched this thing, I was fascinated, I was saddened, and I was inspired. I was fascinated because the numerous views of God, the divergent views of God, you could see how people's views of God were impacting how they were processing it. And it was fascinating to me how that all fit together and how some people were creating God in their own image and were kind of sculpting God to be where they wanted him, he, she, or it to be. It was fascinating how that was working. And I was saddened because I saw that the perception, and in my opinion, the ill-formed perception of God, and I know it sounds incredibly judgmental, but in my opinion, the ill-formed perception of God, I was saddened because I saw that it was putting more pain onto their situation because they weren't seeing God for who he really was. And that was adding more pain. It's one of the reasons we're going to do our service on Tuesday night. You don't want to miss it. Don't want to miss back. There'll be childcare. Come. It's going to be great. But I was saddened by that. But I was inspired by quotes like this that I had to write down from a woman who lost her husband and the father of her only child. Here's what she said. "I can't bring myself to speak to him anymore. I know he exists, but I can't bring myself to talk to him now." I heard that. I saw her. I said, wow, now that is realness. That's realness. You might go, oh, that's an awful thing that someone would intentionally not talk to God, that somebody would intentionally blow off God. I go, that's realness, and that inspires me. In fact, that was the most biblical thing, in my opinion, God-honoring thing, was said the entire program. Because what she was doing is she was following in the lines and in the tradition of the Bible and of historically heroic spiritual figures. Read the book of Psalms in the Old Testament, written predominantly by a guy by the name of King David. And it's basically his prayers written out longhand, his prayer journal. And you read that and you go, whoa, you're saying that to God? He would vent his emotions, the full bandwidth of his emotions to God and say, God, why? Why is it that all these bad people have great things happen and I, a pretty good person, have awful things happen? What? It makes no sense. Hello, God, what are you doing? And you read this and you go, that guy's being real. And that's what that woman was doing. She was being real. And God says, bring it on. I might not like what you're saying. You might be wrong. But you know what God says? I know you're thinking it, so why not express it? Let's be real. This is one place, in a safe place, you can process with me how you're feeling and what's going on down in the depths of your heart. Be real. Don't play games with me. So what Jesus does, let's pick up our story. Here's what happens. Going a little further, he fell to the ground and he prayed that if possible, the hour might pass from him. Abba, Father, he said. This is where, you know, we get the band Abba. You know, dance with me. That's not actually where we get it. Actually, let me tell you what's going on here. When he says Abba, Father, what that really is, that's a term of endearment for God. Where literally what he's saying is, Daddy, Daddy. Now, let me just hit a pause button here for a moment. It's an example of inner life introspection, knowing yourself. You know, God cannot be defined solely in masculine terms. When the Bible uses masculine terms to talk about God, it's not saying God is masculine. Okay? But we've got to ask ourselves the question, if I have a reaction against masculine terms to God or against calling God Father, as opposed to going, oh, that's just not right, why? Is there inner pain, inner unresolved things towards a male figure that I've not dealt with? See, this is the kind of thing we're talking about. Ooh, you know, you start talking about something like that, I mean, you do not want to go there unless you really want to be real. Let's go back to it, though. Daddy, he said, everything's possible for you. Take this cup from me. You're not what I will, but you what you will. Here's what Jesus says. He gets real with God. He says, God, I know you can do anything you want. I know everything's possible for you. And this idea of suffering, this idea of pain, this cup that you're giving me to drink, the cup of pain, the cup of turmoil, you know what? I don't want it. I don't want it. If you can figure out a better way to deal with this whole, world gone astray thing and sin thing and all that, if you can figure out a better way, I am all about that. I don't want to do it. But, God, if this is just what you want to do, if it's the best way, I'll do it. Don't want to do it? Wish there was a better way? But if that's the way it is, I'll do it. That is being real with God. That is godly. It's so insidious that we think we can fake God. Why not just tell him? Why not be real with him? It's one of the reasons why I don't like to affix Christian bumper stickers to anything I own. I don't like putting any saying on a sticker on anything I own. I don't like pinning symbols, religious symbols on me. I don't, you might, and that's fine. That's between you and God. But for me, I don't like doing it for a number of reasons. First is, I don't like to erect a marketing campaign for my preferred self. Plus I can't cut people off in traffic if I have that. I don't want to erect a marketing campaign for myself. The other reason is because God is way too deep to think that any symbol, or any saying can accurately and holistically communicate who he is. It just cannot happen. And so I just decide, I don't want to do that. And in fact, I see people who, in an attempt to be spiritual, are really not being real with God because we throw out these trite sayings and phrases that really might be accurate in and of themselves, but there's a whole other picture beyond it. Stuff like, let go and let God. Jesus loves me just the way I am. When God closed the door, he opens the window. Those things might be technically correct, but you know what? When I'm real with God, if I want to say something like that, you know what it's really about? God, I know that, I should let go and let you deal with stuff, but I know that I have responsibility here. I know that I have responsibility, and I'm not liking that responsibility right now. Well, Jesus, I know you love me just the way I am, but I also know I got these issues in my life that you do not like. And you really need dealt with. And you're not satisfied until I deal with them. And you're calling me to something better. Well, God, I know that, you close windows, you close doors, and these opportunities are closing. But you know what? If you close another door and then you open a window, I think I'm going to jump out of it because I just can't take any more rejection. Don't give me a window. I'll jump out. I'm frustrated right now. I'm about at my wit's end. When we're real with God, that's the full bandwidth of thoughts that we think, the full bandwidth of emotions that we actually admit and communicate, just like Jesus did. And the third realm that we see Jesus do in this story, and the third realm for us, is we need to be real with others, being real with others. Now, this is probably the most difficult thing, being real with others. I mean, if we're real with ourselves, no one else knows. It's just the thing that we can do with God. If it's real with God, it's between us and him, and, God's not going to, say something to us that's going to make us feel really, really bad, probably. But when it starts talking about other people can use us, they can abuse us. If they don't respond the right way, they can bring us more pain. This is rough. And that's why next week we'll spend the whole time about being real with other people. I'll give you an example. By the way, the reason I don't like giving examples about myself, I really don't. The only reason I do it is because you all have told me that kind of hearing some of my story or some of the things I deal with helps you connect the dots in your personal life. And so believe me, I prefer not to talk this way. But I hear that it helps you, so that's what I'm here for. So let me give you an example of how this worked with me, being real with others. Most of you know Brian Wells. He's on staff here. Great guy. Brian was part of 11 people who actually had the initial vision for starting this church. They said, we ought to start someplace for our friends who've given up on church. And so they needed a trained professional to come in and help them. And that was me. Coming in from Pittsburgh, I'm the trained professional coming in with these business people and hanging out with them and doing this or that. We start the church. Things are going great and people are coming and there's incredible needs and we've got too few resources to meet the needs. And one of the things we're too shy on is staff people. So we had to bring our first ministry staff person, a full-time ministry staff person. And the idea came of being Brian, who would be great. He worked at P&G at that point. We thought, gosh, if we can get him to make a career move, it could be huge for us. So we're working on that whole thing. And I get together with him for lunch at Scotty's downtown during lunch. And we go through what his job description will look like and all that stuff. And then I said to him, I said this, Brian, I don't really know how to say this, but I just think you need to know this. I'm a little freaked out about you coming on staff. I'm really struggling with it because you've been here longer than me, and you couple that with the fact that in a lot of areas you're just better than me. And so this is like the classic way that churches split and turmoil happens, and it's just very intimidating for me, you know, to have you have that level of leadership. And I'm just, you know, even though you're going to be reporting to me, it just freaks me out a little bit. So I'm sorry, but I just figured I'd just tell you that. And he went, oh, hey, don't worry. You'll never have to worry about that with me. It will never be a problem. And it never has. Primarily because he's a person who has integrity unlike nearly any other I know. And one of the reasons why our relationship has worked so great, I am convinced, because it went back to that day when we got real with one another. I mean, I don't want to admit that I was insecure in that. I didn't want to, you know, I had no idea how he would take that. I had no idea what would happen. I didn't know. But there's no question that we have worked as well together as we have because of moments of realness like that where the shield was willfully retracted. That's what happens when you get real. Sometimes being real means you're positive and tender, and you just kind of put your heart out there and say, please take this, but be careful with it. Sometimes it's intense. It's intense directness. And this is what we see in this scene with Jesus. Let's go ahead and continue on. Then he returned to his disciples, and he found them sleeping. Simon, he said to Peter, which was another name that Peter went by. Simon, he said to Peter, are you asleep? Could you not keep watch for 1 hour? Watch and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. The spirit's willing, but the body's weak. He's over here praying. He's getting real with himself. He's getting real with God. He says, man, I need to hang out with my boys. I need to go to somebody who has skin on and give me some comfort. So he goes over to his friends. He goes, and they're sleeping. And he goes, Peter, what? 1 hour. I asked you to hand me 1 hour and you can't do that? And we've heard this phrase, you know, the spirit's willing, but the flesh is weak. You know, if you've never read the Bible, you've probably heard that phrase before. Basically what it means is this. He said to Peter, hey, Peter, I guess it's one thing to have great plans. It's entirely another to actually do it, isn't it? Come on. Come on. And he goes back. And he goes back to praying. And here's what it says. Once more, he went away and prayed. The same thing. When he came back again, he found them sleeping. Because their eyes were heavy. They did not know what to say to him. So he prays. He says, I need community. I need to go back with these guys. So he comes back. And they're sleeping again. And this time, you know, you got to really look between the lines and anticipate what's happening here. But I think what happens here is he comes back. This time he gives intense facial expressions. They're kind of dozing off. He goes, you know, he just freaks me out. And they're like, oh, and he can't. And he goes back away. And they're like, oh, man. And they couldn't. They didn't know what to say to him. They didn't know. They were just kind of like, busted. Sorry. And he goes back. And here's what it says. Returning the third time, he goes back away to pray. And he comes back a third time. He says, are you still sleeping and resting? Enough. So he's praying. He comes back again. They're sleeping again. And what's he say? Are you still sleeping? Oh, the last three. for years. I've done life with you. I've taught you. I provided food for you. You've seen miracles. I poured out my life for you. I have totally abandoned many of the things that I want my life to build into you. And now I ask one thing of you, 1 hour of prayer. I ask you to be with me and have my back, and you don't have it. Enough. Enough. That's what happened. Botox Jesus? No, I don't think so. That's what happened. Can you handle Jesus? Full volume Jesus. Because that's who he was. He was full volume. He was real. He was real with himself. He was real with God. And he loved people around him too much to fake it. He needed to be real with them. You know, a number of years ago, the Washington Post reported a story in Worcester, Massachusetts. Adele Gabori was an elderly woman who was loved by her neighbors, and her neighbors hadn't seen her for a while. So they did some checking around and found out that a distant relative of hers informed them that she had actually gone into a nursing home. So they said, okay, well, we'll miss her, but I guess that's the best place for her. Well, they noticed that the grass started getting longer and longer around her home. So one neighbor had a grandson that she paid $10 twice a month to mow the lawn. And so the lawn was dealt with. And then another neighbor sometime later noticed that the mail slot in the front door where the mailman would put the mail was piling so high that actually they could see it in the window as it was piling higher and higher and higher. So in order to serve Adele, he called the post office and had the mail canceled. Then in the wintertime, one other neighbor noticed that there was water coming out from underneath the door because the pipes had frozen and burst. So, solved the problem by going to the utility company and having the power shut off. Sometimes later, the police investigated the house as a potential health hazard and found inside the house the dead body of Adele Gabori, who had been in there for 4 years. Now, the irony of it was everything looked good on the outside. But on the inside, there was death. And that's the way it is with many of us. It's the way it is with many of us. You know, on the outside, we've got the nice clothes. We've got the nice home. We've got the nice job. We've got the nice laugh. And we spend so much time keeping up the veneer and faking it when reality, inside, there's spiritual death. Things are not right. And if you recognize that and you want to go to a different place, this series is for you. Let's pray.